We're talking about unions and collective bargaining here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On Tuesday, Harley-Davidson and two chapters of the United Steelworkers came to the temporary agreement to extend the expired union contract through April 14th while their negotiations are underway. Are you a union member? Do you think right-to-work law in Wisconsin has affected your union? Or are there things more or less the same as they were before? Have you opted out of union membership? Why? Be part of this conversation at 800-642-1234. John Shelton is an associate professor of democracy and justice studies at UW Green Bay. He studies unions, labor, and education. He's author of Teacher Strike, Public Education and the Making of a New American Political Order. John, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me. Good morning, Kate, and good morning to your listeners. It's so great to be with you today.
Well, let's start with the Harley news. First of all, United Steelworkers rejected the five-year deal that Harley offered. Can you explain that for us, the back and forth there, the background of this negotiation?
Yeah, so as you said, the workers for at the Harley plant, who are both at both plants, are members of the United Steelworkers, rejected the contract offer. Now, that's not anything that's kind of outside of the ordinary for labor negotiations, of course. Workers and their employers have been disagreeing since the advent of capitalism in the 19th century in the U.S. But, you know, what's really interesting to me in watching, you know, in being an observer of it, is that the breakdown in negotiations weren't directly about, you know, wages and benefits, right? For the most part, it seems like the workers didn't have a problem with that. What they seem to be concerned about is a contract that would kind of further really a two-tiered sort of workforce that might include more temp workers, and that might allow those temp workers to stay on the job potentially during slack times when permanent workers might be laid off. So, you know, what's really interesting to me about that is that it seems to speak to this really kind of broader political and economic discussion we're having in the United States about the connection between jobs and economic security.
So it wasn't so much about the money being offered on the table or what that pension looked like. It was more about what is the job security? What does the scheduling look like? What would the schedules look like for temporary workers?
Yeah, and I think from my observations of it, it seems like the workers in the union there are worried about a situation where more of the workers would be temp workers, right? And that could, you know, undercut the kind of long-term security that the permanent workers had on the job, right? And it leads to an interesting question, which is, you know, I was listening in on, you know, the sort of news rundown. We have these like historically low unemployment numbers, but why don't more workers feel, you know, secure in their economic livelihood, right? I mean, you could imagine that if working people at Harley felt like they had a really kind of secure long-term outlook, then, you know, they might not be as worried about, you know, more temp workers coming on and effectively kind of taking more of the work that they would have already been doing.
So what happens next in these negotiations? We know that the contract has been, current contract is extended until April 14th.
It looks like they're going to continue to negotiate. Certainly with any labor negotiations, you can never rule out the possibility of a strike. I'm a historian, so I don't make predictions. So I have, you know, no idea what's going to happen. We'll just have to kind of wait and see. But I think the workers, I think, have sent a pretty clear message that, you know, they want an investment in their kind of long-term economic security. And so we'll see what happens there.
We're talking with John Shelton. He's an associate professor of democracy and justice studies at UW Green Bay. You can join in with this conversation, 800-642-1234. Do you think unions have a secure future in Wisconsin? Why or why not? Do you agree with Governor Evers' proposal to roll back right to work in Wisconsin? Why or why not? Let's know what's on your mind at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Well, John, let's take this conversation about Harley and United Steelworkers a little bit broader.
Sure.
What does it tell us about the place of private sector unions in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so I mean, as has been the case across the country, for a variety of reasons, since the kind of high watermark of you know, private sector unionization, which a lot of your listeners might think is maybe in the 1960s or 1970s. It's actually in the early 1950s. So certainly more workers join unions over the course of the second half of the 20th century. But as a percentage of the total private sector workforce, fewer and fewer workers were represented by work by unions as the 20th century went on. And so now we're in a situation where, you know, this may be kind of surprising to some of your listeners, but in the private sector in this country, only about 6.5% of workers are actually represented by a collectively bargained contract. You know, in the 1950s, that was, you know, that number might have been like, or was, you know, 35%. In Wisconsin, the number's a bit higher. There's been a decline in the past few years, not a substantial decline, but you know, certainly the right to work law that was passed in, what was that, 2015, I think, has had at least a marginal impact, I think.
Well, do you see parallels between the Harley-Davidson negotiation and the conflicts that we just saw at Kohler a few years ago?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, so Kohler, which that strike was also in 2015, I believe, you know, it was a similar kind of conflict, actually. So in Kohler, I mean, a little different. Kohler had negotiated after the economic crisis in 2008. The workers there had negotiated effectively a two-tiered labor structure. So there would be Tier A workers, who are people who are already working there, long-term employees, and then tier, basically everybody hired after that agreement was reached would be brought in a second tier. So lower wages, diminished benefits. And the strike that happened in 2015 that I'm betting a lot of your listeners remember was really a conflict over doing something for those Tier B workers to bring everybody up to the same level. Now, I think the union there really saw that strike as being successful. They weren't able to achieve total parity, but they were able to really improve substantially the wages and conditions for the Tier B workers. So it is interesting, particularly when you put this in the context of some of the, and we don't have to go this road if you don't want to, but you know, in the context of some of the public sector labor conflict that we've seen in the past couple of years, that I think you're seeing a lot of unions now who are really kind of broadening their demands in contract negotiations beyond just, you know, the immediate wages and working conditions, and to more equity at the workplace and, you know, more long-term sort of job security. And certainly the teachers who are going on strike in this country are also thinking about the very state of public education. So I think there's been these examples are showing that, you know, there's very much an open question about the future of labor and economic security in the U.S.
We're talking about unions and collective bargaining on The Morning Show. John Shelton is an associate professor of democracy and justice studies at UW Green Bay, studying unions and labor. We're gathering your thoughts and questions along the way at 800-642-1234. What do you think about Governor Evers wanting to bring back prevailing wage protections? Do you worry that could harm the economy, especially construction, or do you think it would be good for workers? You can call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back in just a minute on this conversation about unions and collective bargaining right here on the Ideas Network. It's a conversation about labor unions and right to work on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Tony Evers' budget is proposing a repeal of the right to work law and restoring the prevailing wage law for state and local public works projects. Here is Governor Evers addressing the Wisconsin AFL-CIO Building Trades Conference last month.
We're going to begin to undo the harm that has been done to organized labor.
Are you a union member? Do you think right-to-work law in Wisconsin has affected your union, or are things more or less the same as they were before? There is a line for your story at 800-642-1234. John Shelton is our guide. He's an associate professor of democracy and justice studies at UW-Green Bay, where he studies unions. Let's go to the phones now with Sarah joining us from Green Bay. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning. I was just calling. I love hearing John on the air, and I have actually been a huge proponent of teachers' unions, and I am a teacher that's a part of a union. But the struggle that I've been having this year is that I've been bringing to light a lot of inequitable practices and policies in my district, and I have felt a severe lack of support from my union representatives in terms of changing those policies and practices. And I was just wondering if John had any advice as to how to navigate those issues.
Can you be a little bit more specific about some of these inequities that you're seeing?
Sure. Just in terms of, for example, wanting to lead a group at my school to talk about how to be better anti-racist white educators, and having people complain to their representatives about the fact that I'm running those things, and then representatives basically not really encouraging me to continue those conversations, and actually in some instances telling me to cease communication altogether about certain policies that I've addressed with our school board.
John, what do you make of what Sarah's saying there?
Wow, Sarah, that's a great question and a tough question this early in the morning. So thanks for the question. What I would say is, you know, when unions are at their best, they're democratic. I can't speak to your union specifically, but, you know, I do know that not every union's perfect. And, you know, I would encourage you to find others in the union that can be your allies, other people at your workplace. It can take time to change a union that you feel like isn't responsive to the things that you want to see happen. So there's probably a much longer answer there, but I think the shorter answer there is don't stop trying. Look for other allies, you know, unions have elections, and so you can always challenge leadership at the ballot box if it comes to that.
Sarah, thanks for the call. John, going back to 2015, can you remind us what the right to work law does and its impact on unions' power?
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. So there's a lot of misconceptions about what right to work laws do. Basically, so we have a federal law called the National Labor Relations Act that was passed in the 1930s, and there was a revision to that law in the late 1940s, 1947 actually, that allowed individual states to pass what were called right-to-work laws. And it doesn't give anybody the right to a job. It's kind of a misnomer. What a right-to-work law does is it ensures that a working person who is at a workplace, now this is only in the private sector, I should remind your listeners, who is covered by a collectively bargained contract, cannot be obligated to contribute to the representation costs of the union. So I should also remind your listeners that there's another part of the National Labor Relations Act that obligates unions to represent every single person at the workplace, right? And every union in this country that has a collectively bargained contract has been voted into office. Has been voted to represent the workers. To Sarah's question about unions, I would just remind everybody that every union has democratic elections for their leadership and to represent workers. But they also, once that happens, at least in the private sector and in most states too, in the public sector, they have the duty to represent every worker at the workplace. And so many unions in the past have negotiated in states where it's allowed contracts where those who benefit from the contract also pay what are called agency fees, or sometimes called in the public sector, sometimes called fair share fees, or at least that's what was the case before the Janus decision. And so the idea being that they should, everybody who benefits from the contract should contribute to it. And so what right to work laws do is allow a state to say, we're not going to allow those kinds of contracts to exist. And so, unions sometimes call this the free rider problem, that people can, in those states, benefit from the contract and not have to pay any representation costs.
Are there unions that are more vulnerable when it comes to right to work law?
That's a good question. I don't think there's necessarily any particular sector where workers are, where unions are more vulnerable. But I think the unions that, so of course, you know, about 25 states have right to work laws. And as probably some of your listeners know, but I should just explain briefly what the Supreme Court case did back last summer, the Janus versus AFSCME case, is it effectively made every public sector workplace in this country right to work. You know, we're still looking to see kind of what the impact of that would be. But probably the workplaces that are more sort of vulnerable to right to work laws are those in which you don't have an extremely active union membership, because when workers really see the value of a union, and when you have unions that are, you know, truly kind of representing the union leadership, that are truly representing the workers at the workplace, and those workers feel like they have a voice and that they're being represented, well, just about everybody at that workplace is going to see the value in the union, right? A few people will still not pay representation costs for whatever reason, but most people are going to continue to want the union, because the union, for most people, I mean, there's a significant wage premium. We know that in public education, for example, teachers who have strong unions feel like they really have a voice in their workplace, and that leads them to be more happy with their jobs and actually do a better job. So when unions are democratic, I guess what I'm saying, and they truly kind of represent the workers who work there, and those people are extremely active, you know, those unions have not been too affected by right-to-work laws, at least so far.
Governor Evers has proposed repealing the state's right-to-work law. Do you think that there is any chance of that actually happening with a Republican-controlled legislature?
You know, I don't. You know, certainly the turn that the Republican Party has made, and I'm saying nationally now, you know, in the past couple of decades, is a much more conservative turn. You know, there used to be Republicans in the United States who strongly supported unions. For example, I'll just give your listeners one example from Michigan. Everybody probably knows Mitt Romney. Well, Mitt Romney's dad was a Republican, obviously, in the state of Michigan, and he actually signed into law the law that gave teachers and other public employees the right to have a union, the right to collective bargaining, back in the 1960s. But the Republican Party has shifted pretty far from that. You don't find a lot of Republicans who support very strong union rights. But what I will say that's interesting is, I do think that it's interesting that Governor Evers didn't propose repealing Act 10. And I think maybe the reason for that is because repealing the right to work law, for at least some Republicans, is probably more palatable than Act 10. And the reason I say that is because, you know, even Governor Walker, he actually, it's been documented that, you know, he promised, he had several, you know, unions that supported him in 2010 and 2014, and he actually promised that he wasn't going to pass a right to work law, that he would not sign it. And then, you know, of course, he reneged on that promise. But the point is that I do think it's more likely that Republicans in the state would entertain the idea of repealing the right to work law, because, you know, particularly with some unions in construction, I think some Republicans and some business owners actually really see the value in what unions do, training workers, making sure that they're equipped to follow safety guidelines and those kinds of things. So I think it's more likely, I think it's more likely that Republicans would support that than repealing Act 10, but not very likely.
And Governor Evers has also said he'd like to bring back the prevailing wage in Wisconsin. Help us understand what prevailing wage is.
Sure. So prevailing wage laws have a long history in the United States. There's a federal version called the Davis-Bacon Act that is still in the books, and that ensures that government projects with federal funding follow the prevailing wage. And there's also has been a series of state laws going back to the early 20th century. And the idea is that the government can use its sort of power to make sure that it doesn't diminish the wages of other workers. So a prevailing wage basically says that the government is not going to pay any any workers who are involved in its contracts less than what the sort of average wage is in a particular place. So in Wisconsin, I think the prevailing wage law that existed said that government contracts couldn't pay workers in a county less than what the sort of average wage was for workers in that county. And so the idea is that, you know, rather than using competition to bring everyone's wages down in a race to the bottom, the government has an obligation to support good wages for workers.
John, thank you for joining us.
It's been a real pleasure, Kate. Thank you.
John Shelton is an associate professor of democracy and justice studies at UW Green Bay, where he studies unions, labor, and education, author of the book Teacher Strike, Public Education, and the Making of a New American Political Order. Coming up, we talk with the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs Secretary about the priorities for her agency. That's after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about Wisconsin Veterans Affairs on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs was created in 1945 to consolidate separate veterans programs under one agency roof, and it covers veterans' homes, memorial cemeteries, and the Veterans Assistance Program, to name a few. The agency has about 1,300 employees throughout the state. Veterans, we want to hear from you. What would you like the secretary to know? How are things going for you? What programs or resources have been helpful? And where do you need more support? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Mary Kohler is secretary designee of the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs. She completed nearly three decades of service with the U.S. Navy. She previously worked on the Dane County Board of Supervisors and with the Dane County Veterans Service Office. Secretary designee Kohler, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. It's a great honor to be here.
Well, let's start with your decades in the Navy. You had roles ranging from executive officer to boot camp recruiter. How does your military service inform the decisions you're making here at the head of the VA?
Well, while I was on active duty and including being the executive officer at Recruit Training Command, the Navy's only boot camp, plus I had five tours of either being the officer in charge or the commanding officer, plus I was the chief of staff at Naval Service Training Command. We were responsible for everyone who joined the Navy except for the Naval Academy. We had 90,000 students located worldwide. So having the experience of leading large organizations, managing large budgets, it has prepared me to take on this role of representing over 360,000 veterans and their families in the state of Wisconsin. I had the honor of attending boot camp graduations and seeing sailors begin their Navy careers. Now I'm just very pleased to be able to support veterans who have served their country and come back to Wisconsin, and I want to ensure that they know of the benefits and services that are available to them in Wisconsin.
It's kind of like you're on the other end of the continuum.
Exactly.
What do you hope to accomplish in your tenure as Wisconsin Secretary of the VA?
Well, I really appreciate opportunities like this, your request that veterans reach out to your caller to call you today, and working with county veteran service offices, working with our people, WDVA's people throughout the state, to have that conversation, to not say no to yourself before you even ask what programs for veterans am I eligible for. That's what I'm very pleased to be here for. That, do you hear my voice? Do you hear that as a veteran, there are programs that Wisconsin offers? Wisconsin is a very generous state with veterans programs, services, and benefits. Go see. We have people who are doing outreach. We have work with veteran service organizations like the American Legion, the VFW, Disabled American Veterans. And we're doing that drumbeat of, hey, fellow veteran, did you know you could get this this service. So our sense is that there's as much as 50% or more veterans in the state who don't realize what they're entitled to.
What is out there. Well, let's look at the three veterans' homes, Chippewa Falls, King, and Union Grove. And the three homes have really struggled to maintain adequate staffing levels and suffer from high turnover. What is behind that?
One of the factors that we have here in Wisconsin right now, the unemployment rate is extremely low. We're competing with one another. Amongst the first conversations I had with my fellow cabinet members, particularly Department of Health Services, Department of Workforce Development, Department of Corrections, is let's work together to ensure that we're able to attract the employees that we need and pay them adequately and not compete with one another. So we're working on that. And I know Governor Evers has it in his proposed budget that we pay employees a fair wage and that they're able to come. So I just want to clarify, too, in Chippewa Falls, we have a contracted, it's a public-private venture, and that is a 72-member home. And we don't have as much turnover there, but I think that the size of that is a great impact. At our Union Grove facility, as I have met with all of the state senators and some of the assembly members, I mentioned that, you know, whatever your position is on Foxconn, that's another employer that we're now, Foxconn and the spinoffs in that area, we're competing for a limited number of potential employees. So that's our challenge at Union Grove. Again, we don't have a large turnover, but enough that it is a concern. In King, we have a very large home, and so the population in the area is part of the challenge, is getting enough members in the workforce to be able to maintain the level of staffing that we would like at that home.
And King has also faced criticism for poor conditions. Has the current funding model taken resources away from the home's care?
No. I want to emphatically state, and yes, the homes at King had some negative publicity 2 years ago, understandably so for why. But I encourage you and others to go see the home at King. It is absolutely wonderful place to be. Our homes are for quality of care are five star rated. We compete very well with the private industry of providing nursing home care. So come see it. Come see what a great place it is. Our population is, again, steadily increasing. I regret and want to address any issues, but as I assured the assembly at a hearing last week, our care is top quality, and I will continue to ensure that that's true, that the care at our homes, all three homes, maintains that five-star quality of care.
Seems there's this push of capital improvements going on at King, including this 192-bed skilled nursing facility opening in 2021. But is providing up-to-date facilities, new facilities, a financial challenge? Where do you find the funding?
If one of the challenges that I have at WDVA is our finances in the past, because of the high number of people that we did have when our homes were at capacity, basically because of the federal dollars that we receive, because we serve veterans, the homes were taken care of, we could build, plus we had enough revenue left to fund other programs in the department. Because of our lower population, particularly at King, that is a financial challenge. So in the governor's budget, we will continue to fund some WDVA programs from the homes. But as I have stated, it's not financially viable to keep that. So the governor has asked for GPR in the second year of the biennium.
We're talking with Veterans Affairs Secretary Mary Kohler. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Specifically, veterans, we'd love to hear from you. What do you want to talk about with the secretary? How are things going for you in your life? And what programs or resources have been most helpful for you? Where do you need extra support? Share your experience at 800-642-1234. Last year, the Wisconsin VA renewed a grant that enabled it to expand its Veterans Outreach and Recovery Program to all counties. What is the goal of this program?
The Veterans Outreach and Recovery Program, our goal is to reach veterans who most need care, and most particularly for mental health and substance abuse challenges. They literally go out and go to railroad yards, go find people under overpasses. They go and find veterans, develop relationships of trust, and help these veterans get the assistance that they need. The VORP, as we call it, the VORP coordinators, there's currently 11 located throughout the state. They work, again, with county veteran service offices, veteran service organizations, other nonprofits to get veterans the help that they need. This program has been extremely successful. We have over 550 veterans who we've been able to assist in just since last April, so in just a year. And also we have community relationships that we've developed with over 1,200 people. Again, if there are programs that WDV has that sometimes we have to say, okay, you didn't meet this qualification for a WDVA program, but we know this organization here that's able to help you. We truly believe and have documentation that we have prevented suicides because we get people the help that they need.
So when the program initially started in 2014, it was to assist homeless veterans with substance abuse challenges in rural areas. Is there still work to be done there? Has the homelessness rate of Wisconsin's veterans decreased?
I believe we have a steadily declining rate of homelessness among veterans. The original program was federally funded. It was in 42 rural counties. It has been expanded to all 72 counties. It had gotten an appropriation from the state legislature, and it is my top priority in the budget submission that I sent to the governor, and it is in his request for the budget for the biennium. It's a program that's working. It is those relationships in the communities where people live and, you know, that's it, and throughout the state.
70% of homeless veterans have substance abuse issues. 50% have mental illness. How do we better support veterans with mental illness?
It is developing those relationships of trust. I had a recent opportunity to visit our homeless program that's in Green Bay. It's housing in Green Bay. And to talk also at the same time that here's this program that we have to when we find the people and get them a place to live temporarily up to 2 years at one of our four homeless program facilities. The VORP coordinator was there, and I asked him, okay, how is he working to ensure that he maintains these relationships? So here was a person who he had developed a relationship with, but had gone, left the homeless facility. Okay, what did Ken Corey do? He went to the police. He went to a shelter. He has these relationships, and like, oh, we know where he is. And they got him back and got him back on track. So that's how I believe we're doing it. It is those relationships in whatever community a veteran is in, and he or she has able to develop that relationship with our coordinators.
We're talking with Wisconsin's Veterans Affairs Secretary Mary Kohler, looking at your questions as well at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment with continued conversation here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about Wisconsin Veterans Affairs here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, looking at agency priorities, challenges. A new Inspector General report published last week investigated multiple allegations against the Tomah VA Medical Center. One of those was that staff were being forced to write prescriptions that they weren't comfortable with. Nearly all of the claims were not substantiated. And Center Director Victoria Brom praised the report's conclusions and said staff have worked hard to change the culture in the wake of a 2015 scandal that found doctors overprescribed narcotics.
This just gives us another opportunity to show the public that not only have we proven prior how much we've changed the culture here, but now we can prove that we've sustained that.
And we're talking with Veterans Affairs Secretary Mary Kohler, who stays with us for this conversation. Mary, looking at the report coming from the Inspector General on the Tomah VA, the report did not substantiate many of the claims related to overprescription, but it proved a poor environment of care and high staffing turnover at the Wausau Clinic. So where do you go from here now that this investigation is concluded?
It's keeping the lines of communication open and still holding people accountable. The Toma VA, the federal VA, had a situation where they did have an employee. You know, I'm glad to see the report, glad to see the results. Toma deserves an excellent reputation. They held a doctor accountable who did do what he was accused of doing. But working with, as the director of the Toma VA has stated, working with her staff, and working with veteran service organizations. I recently had a meeting with the leaders of the State Department or the State Disabled American Veterans. And their words were, something negative happened and they turned it into a positive. They were very commendable of the Toma VA for how they took something bad. I won't speak for the VA too much. That's a federal VA. I'm the state mm-hmm. Veterans Affairs. But I believe that it just really highlights how we have to give feedback to whatever organization. When I speak to groups, I say, hold us accountable. The Toma VA was held accountable, and they took action, and it's great to hear the results, the confirming that, okay, yes, something happened. Just like earlier when you asked me about the homes, when there was an incident, people were held accountable, but I assure people that our homes are five-star. And yes, we have challenges, we have to adapt, but keep us informed. You see something, you know something, say something, and let us know if there's a correction we need to make that you see.
Let's go to the phones now with Robert joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Robert.
Hey, good morning. Good morning, Secretary, and welcome aboard. I'm a 24-year Navy veteran, currently working as a VA nurse, and I work intimately with the state programs. And shout out to a couple of your employees who are nothing short of heroic, and that's Derek Jablonicki. He works as your DVOP. And then Tom Beverly, they work intimately, and we just solve veterans' problems together. And I've reached out to them for so many things, so many times, and the outcome is always success. One concern I had was the new facility we have here in Green Bay,
okay.
and the location in relationship to public transportation. That's kind of problematic in that if you have to walk a mile and a half in the snow to get a bus, then it inhibits your ability to be employed.
Robert, thank you for the call.
And thank you, Robert, and thank you for mentioning the organizations that you work with that are supporting veterans and working together. And I appreciate your comments about transportation to the facility that is in Green Bay. It was one of the issues that the DAV brought up to me. And when I visited, just by coincidence, I did talk about it at the facility. When I was leaving, and this was a day that the snow was already melted, I saw a person who, he had his Navy ball cap on and so forth. And since his proximity to the facility I just pulled out of, I said, I wonder if he's walking there. And he's walking on the side of the road. What was it like when the snow was all there? So the safety of the people are using it. And as you mentioned, getting to employment. So I will say that we are working on that. What can we do? I think by your asking that question, I'm imagining people are hearing this, and I will not be surprised if I don't hear from somebody that says, hey, I have a recommendation for what we can do in Green Bay. So I greatly appreciate your question and highlighting that challenge that we have.
Well, let's go to Marie in Cambridge now. Marie, hi.
Hello.
Hi, are you there, Marie?
Yeah, bear with me here. My husband was a veteran in the Navy for 30 years. He just had a catastrophic stroke. I was told to get on Medicaid, which I did. My liability is they're taking his retirement, which I understand, but they're taking half of my income. And I'm so afraid because I cannot afford a lawyer. I'm afraid of going into poverty and losing everything because I'm supposed to live on $500 a month. And so where can I get help? Just some type of help with,
right.
Yeah.
I can't afford
Marie, let's let the secretary respond because we are short of time.
So, Marie, I would appreciate if you would reach out to the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs. You can call us or email us, and also if you aren't able to call us, your local county veteran service officer, let's sit down with a person that we can review your circumstances, your husband's, and let you know what may be available to you so that you are able to address these challenges. That, you know, and the bottom line is this is a radio call-in program, but just make sure that we follow up with you to get you the assistance that you need.
How do we help veterans avoid falling into a cycle of opioid addiction and abuse?
It's our national challenge. You know, the VA, that issue with one doctor was just part of it. I just, NPR is covering it right now about the challenge of in communities. We have to work together. The state, it's a nonpartisan issue of legislators, the governor, agencies such as WDVA working together, that we cannot continue with people feeling that they a pill's going to solve their problem. So it's a combined effort we have to work on together to address.
Let's look at a group that's often felt overlooked, and that's female veterans.
Yes.
You were just part of the I Am Not Invisible project. Can you tell us about that experience?
Oh, it was absolutely wonderful. The photographer for Secretary Wilkie, the Federal Department of Veterans Affairs, is going throughout the country. We were the ninth state to participate. But he's taking photos of female veterans to just highlight the fact that there are female veterans. And I'm so glad you asked me that question. And being on this program and people hearing my voice, and particularly women veterans, many veterans will say, well, I'm not a real veteran. I just heard it from a person the other day. Well, I was just sat at a desk. You're a veteran. There are programs that you're entitled to. You earned because you were willing to literally risk your life to serve your country. Please check with your county veteran service office or the WDVA on the programs you're entitled to. To hear Marie's voice, ask those questions, get the help. Please don't think you're not entitled to something. Find out what you are entitled to. Please ask us.
How can we make Wisconsin the place for our nation's veterans to call home?
You know, obviously I'm prejudiced. I grew up in Wisconsin and I chose to come back to Wisconsin. I think this is an absolutely beautiful place to be. And Wisconsin is one of the more generous states for veterans benefits, whether it's the Wisconsin GI Bill, the other programs that we have at WDVA. Come and enjoy the great life that we have here in Wisconsin.
And as we quickly here, as we run out of time, you know, what is the biggest priority on your desk today that you're grappling with, that you're trying to fix?
Nationally, as we have our challenge for getting enough employees at senior care facilities. For us, it's veterans, and we want to ensure that we continue to ensure that veterans, and particularly at our homes, have the top quality health care that they deserve.
Secretary Kohler, thank you so much for joining us.
Kate, thank you very much.
Mary Kohler is Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs, and we've been looking at her priorities and goals for the agency. Join us Tuesday at 1 for the annual State of the Tribes Address, streaming online at WPR.org. Oneida Nation Chairman Tehasi Hill presents the address before a joint session of the Wisconsin Legislature. That's the State of the Tribes Address, Tuesday at 1, streaming online at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.